This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome to the ICERM Radio program. Let's talk about it. I welcome you, our listeners, or those who have joined us today from many countries around the world to listen to what is going to be an enlightening discussion on the Niger Delta Avengers, the Niger Delta Avengers war on oil installations in Nigeria, an interview that is going to be featuring Ambassador John Kembo, the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. He's also a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria from 2004 to 2007. I am your host, Basil Ugoji. I bring you peace and blessings. And if you are joining us for the first time, especially those who have come to ask one or two questions here, those who have joined us, who have called into this very studio, I welcome you in a special way to this global network, a global peace network, where we dedicate our time, skills, and resources to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation. This program is brought to you by the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, a New York-based nonprofit organization in special consultative status with the United Nations Economic and Social Council. As an emerging center of excellence for ethnic and religious conflict resolution and peace building, ICERM identifies ethnic and religious conflict prevention and resolution needs and brings together a wealth of resources, including mediation and dialogue, to support sustainable peace in countries around the world, especially in Africa. For today's important and timely discussion on the Niger Delta Avengers war on oil installations in Nigeria, we have with us in our studio a renowned scholar, practitioner, diplomat, and expert in both historical and emerging conflicts in Nigeria. Ambassador Kembo is the author of Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, a book published by Roman and Littlefield. The second edition was published in June 2013. He's also the author of Africa in Transition, a blog that tracks the most important political, security, and social developments occurring in sub-Saharan Africa. He edits the Nigeria Security Tracker, a project of the Council on Foreign Relations Africa program, which documents and maps violence in Nigeria, especially those violence are motivated by political, economic, and social grievances. And from 1975 to 2007, Ambassador Kembo served as the U.S. Department of State Foreign Service Officer. He served twice in Nigeria as political counselor from 1988 to 1990, and as ambassador from 2004 to 2007. Ambassador Kembo, he's here with us in our studio. It's just a great honor. We are thrilled to have you on the ICERM Radio program. Let's talk about it. Thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And to you, our listeners, and all those who have called in to ask questions or add their voice to the conversation, once again, I welcome you to this important discussion. Ambassador Kembo today will share his views on the security, political, and economic challenges posed by the Niger Delta Avengers war on oil installations in Nigeria, the Nigeria's newest militant group from the Niger Delta region of Nigeria. The Niger Delta Avengers claims their struggle is focused on the liberation of the people of Niger Delta from decades of divisive rule and exclusion. According to the group, the war is on oil installations, which they call Operation of Flow of Oil. In this discussion, we'll approach the Niger Delta Avengers case, especially this very war on oil installations, from a historical perspective, going back to the activism of Ken Saro-Wiwa, an environmental activist who was condemned to death by hanging in 1995 by the military regime of Sani Abacha. We'll also make a comparative analysis between the Niger Delta Avengers war on oil installations in Nigeria and the agitation for independence by the indigenous people of Biafra, as well as the current terrorist activities of the Boko Haram movement in Nigeria and also within the neighboring countries. The goal is to highlight how these challenges have posed serious threats to the Nigerian security and contributed in crippling the Nigerian economy. In the end, we will examine possible resolution strategies to inspire the Nigerian government to action. Let me quickly turn to Ambassador John Kemble. Ambassador Kemble, you served twice in Nigeria as a diplomat from 1988 to 1990, and also as ambassador of the U.S. To Nigeria from 2004 to 2007. And since your return to the United States, you have dedicated your work at the Council on Foreign Relations to documenting and mapping violence in Nigeria to influence policies and create some kind of relationship between the U.S. and Nigeria. And you have been focusing on those violence that are motivated by political, economic, and social grievances, which, of course, pose enormous threats not only to the Nigerian security, but also to global peace and security. Could you please explain to us what the Nigeria security tracker is, the current violence you are tracking, and why you initiated this very important project? Does it have anything to do with your experience living in Nigeria?
The Nigeria Security Tracker is based on publicly available information, primarily from the Nigerian media. The purpose of it was to provide some degree of precision with respect to the number of people who were being killed by political, ethnic, religious violence in Nigeria. It was designed to provide some degree of precision about a topic which was extremely unclear. Now, because the security tracker is based on publicly available sources, mostly the Nigerian media, it almost certainly understates the number of casualties. But I think the security tracker is accurate with respect to trend lines. In other words, when the security tracker's graphs show that violence is increasing or decreasing, that, I think, is a good representation of the reality. When we're talking about absolute numbers, how many people were killed in a particular time frame, then I think the numbers probably are understated in terms of the reality. Some NGOs will say, for example, that the official numbers, the numbers that are released by the security services, will often understate the number of casualties by a factor of four or five.
It's an amazing or very important initiative that you have taken, and honestly, a lot of people, I'm sure, both NGOs and government representatives, policymakers, those who are interested in Nigeria, looking to get more insight about what is going on in Nigeria. But again, not only in Nigeria, the blog, which is very important that you have been working on tracking conflict and violent developments in West Africa is actually very phenomenal. But again, I want to remind our listeners that you have also published a book. You are the author of Nigeria, Dancing on the Brink, a book published by Roman in Littlefield. And you have the second edition published in June 2013. Now, your book offers a history of Nigeria from colonialism to independence to the flawed elections in 2007, which undermined the credibility of the government and left Nigeria's conflicts unresolved. And one of the conflicts we are looking at today is the problem, the conflict within the Niger Delta region. And one of the positions that you have taken, especially in your book, is that, and I quote, governance, let alone democracy, faces grievous or structural challenges in Nigeria. And you believe that popular alienation and a fragmented establishment have contributed to Nigeria becoming one of the most religious and at the same time one of the most violent conflict countries in the world. We see this very violence every day in Nigeria. And right now we have a very big problem within the Niger Delta region. And you believe that corrupt behavior fueled by oil money is a root cause of Nigeria's political and economic problem. Could you explain a little bit from a historical perspective why you believe that the issues around the Niger Delta area could be regarded as one of the root causes of Nigeria's political and economic problem?
The first point to be made is that the elections of 2015 were a shift in Nigeria's trajectory, a shift for the better. Those elections were more credible than the previous ones had been. And of course, for the first time, the leader of the opposition, Muhammadu Buhari, came into office, was elected president through the ballot box. Now, the role of oil in Nigerian corruption, it's complicated. Let me remind our audience that in 1960, when Nigeria became independent, the country was the breadbasket of West Africa. It was a major exporter of food. It was also a major exporter of cotton. There was a vibrant manufacturing sector. The railway network played an important role in bringing agricultural crops to market. Mm-hmm. And in fact, or so, Nigeria's level of development was said to be much the same as in Malaysia or Thailand or in Taiwan. Well, what happened? I would suggest two things. The first was the Civil War and the militarization of Nigerian politics, followed by more than 30 years of military rule. Secondly, oil came online big time, roughly about 1970. It first became commercially viable in the mid-1950s, but it became a major part of the economy right after the Civil War, in a period in which institutions had not been established to cope with the sudden explosion of oil wealth. Oil and gas are the property of the state. Mm-hmm. That means a way to get rich is not through normal economic activity, but rather through capturing the state, which gives access to the enormous amounts of oil revenue. What this does is it makes politics essentially a do-or-die activity, and it also encourages political violence. If politics is the way you get rich, holding or gaining and holding office is something that very often you're willing to commit violence to achieve.
Wonderful. And we see a very big problem right now within the Niger Delta, the area, the very location where this very oil is located, where the oil comes from. And if you look at what is going on, especially in Nigeria and the media headlines, not only in Nigeria, but again around the world, everybody is kind of focusing on the Niger Delta Avengers activities within the Niger Delta region, their war on oil installations in Nigeria. This is no longer a national problem, but again, an international problem, because many of the oil companies are multinational companies. They are not only local companies. So it affects people from many countries. It affects economies, international economies. Looking at this from a historical perspective, going back to the activism of Ken Saro-Wiwa, an environmental activist who was condemned to death by hanging in 1995 by the military regime of Sani Abacha. Ken Saro-Wiwa was an advocate, advocating for the needs of the Niger Delta people for justice, and asking oil companies to have mercy on their environment, pollution and land pollution and polluting waters and all that they depended on for their survival. But he was condemned to death. And after that, we had the emergence of Mende movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta. And the previous administration granted amnesty to this very militant group. And I just want to ask you if you could, from this very perspective of history, having lived in Nigeria and also having most probably known some of the presidents who were actively involved in this very historical conflict in Nigeria, how would you describe the shift from activism of Ken Saro-Wiwa to the movement for the emancipation of the Niger Delta people up to the Niger Delta Avengers activities, the current violent activities within the Niger Delta region?
There's certain core grievances that have existed in the region for a long time. The first is the extensive pollution that you have already referred to. That can be devastating for people who predominantly earn their living through fishing and farming. That's the first issue. The second issue is people who live in the Niger Delta believe, in many cases quite passionately, that they do not benefit from the enormous wealth that is produced by oil and gas in their own region, and that that is fundamentally unfair. Revenue from oil and gas is distributed by the federal government throughout the federation. There is a formula that is used. Under that formula, the oil-producing states get a bit more, about 11% more, than they would otherwise receive. But many people who live in the Niger Delta think that that is too small, that in fact they ought to get a great deal more. Now, the second part of your question, how to distinguish between the work of Ken Saro-Wiwa, for example, MEND, and the Avengers. The principal difference amongst the three is both the degree of violence that they use. The Avengers right now seem to be more violent than their predecessors. And secondly, the extent of destruction that they cause. again, the Avengers have already destroyed more than men did and have driven Nigerian oil production down to 20-year lows. So it's rather an intensification over time that I think is most striking if we look at the trajectory from Kinsera Wewa to now.
Yes. Can you hear us now, Ambassador Kimball?
Hello, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We were cut off.
Oh, sorry about that. We had a technical problem. We just want to apologize for that glitch here. Yeah, thank you so much for your response to my question with respect to the historical development. One of the things that the Niger Delta, the Avengers put up on their website, which is very much active, and also on their Twitter account, they've been very, very active using social media. And one of their positions is that they are not actually fighting the government, even though the government seems to be a major party to this very conflict, but that their war is on the oil installations within their region, and for that reason, they want to liberate their people. And recently, yesterday, they put out a message condemning Mende, saying that Mende has been complicit with previous administrations. And so for that reason, that they want to distinguish themselves from Mende. And another thing this group is saying is that they are young people, well-educated. And again, if you look at what they are putting out there using social media on their website, these are well-coordinated. I want to ask you if you could easily let us know, explain from an analytical perspective what you think. I know you mentioned our dormant grievances and injustice and all that. At this very time, when the previous administration, especially the past president, is from the Niger Delta region, why should this group wait until the previous president, Goodluck, president of Nigeria, leave office? And now that we have a president from the northern part of Nigeria, why is it a coincidence, or are there some political motives behind the emergence of the Avengers?
I think there's some distinctions that we have to be careful to make. If you look at what the Avengers have said on their website or in their tweets, it seems to boil down to war on the oil companies, driving the oil companies out of the Delta, but secondly, also the creation of an independent state. Now, we must ask ourselves, how authoritative is the Avengers website or its tweets? Who's putting it together? Who, in fact, is a credible spokesman for the Avengers? We don't know. We don't even know how the Avengers are organized or who their leaders are. Do know is that they are able to carry out highly destructive operations against oil facilities, and that their approach can be highly sophisticated. I'm thinking here of things like the attack on underwater facilities. To me, that lends some credence to their claims that they are educated. Though, again, on their website, there's certain curious dimensions to it. In some cases, they say many of them have been educated in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Eastern Europe? Why there? There have never been, certainly not since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there have never been large numbers of Nigerian students in Eastern Europe. So there are things here that really don't quite add up. And for that reason, I think we have to be extremely skeptical about flat statements about the Avengers. And in fact, fall back on what we do know. And what we do know is that they have carried out highly destructive attacks on the oil industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the second part of your question is, which essentially is there any relationship between the upsurge in violence in the Delta and the fact that a northerner defeated a southerner and became president of Nigeria in 2015? Again, it's very hard to know. It's pure speculation. However, President Buhari has said that the program put in place by his predecessors and which involved substantial payments to former Niger Delta militants has to be scaled back. And in fact, he reduced the amount of money available to the program in his most recent budget. A second dimension is that President Buhari is not particularly popular in the South and the East, and he did not win the Delta states in the last election. Therefore, there may well be residual resentment amongst the people who live there against his government. But again, I think we have to be very careful not to claim more than we actually know.
Mm-hmm. This is very, very, very important. And the present administration, President Buhari, has honestly, his administration has been trying to negotiate with the Niger Delta Avengers. There is a committee that is being put together to negotiate. And again, the Niger Delta Avengers said publicly that we are not negotiating with any committee. And if federal government is discussing with any group, they said they are not really the ones. So they're not interested in any form of negotiation, any form of discussion. All they want is kind of to destroy oil facilities or destroy them and most probably have total control of the oil within the Niger Delta region. I want to ask you, Ambassador Kembo, I know you have been monitoring since last year the recent developments in the southeastern part of Nigeria, an area that is currently, I mean, that is historically known as the Biafra land. As you said at the beginning, from 1967 to 1970, the Biafra people were in war with the government of Nigeria. And even though, clearly, no victor, no vanquish, which means nobody won the war. But again, the animosities are, you know, continue to persist. And we saw what happened last year when the UK-based Biafran, pro-Biafran activist Nnamdi Kanu was arrested in Nigeria, I think around October, and that led to a massive protest within the southeastern part of Nigeria and also at the international level. And up to today, the protest and the agitation continues while the leader of the indigenous peoples, people of Biafra, is still held in detention. And there have been series of kind of negotiation going on between the Niger Delta people and the pro-Biafra independence people. I want to ask you if you could analyze this situation. Is there a correlation between the emergence of the Avengers and the pro-Biafran independent movement that we saw last year and that continues actually up to today?
It's complicated. Let's go back to the period of the Civil War from 1967 to 1970. There were important ethnic differences between the Igbo and the Ijaw. It is the Ijaw that dominate the oil-producing areas, not the Igbo. And relations between those two people in the past have not necessarily been particularly good. On the other hand, the Niger Delta Avengers, in their in social media, have talked about reaching out to pro-Biafra elements. This is a relatively new thing. Situations evolve over time. And indeed, there may be negotiations of some sort going on amongst people who claim to be pro-Biafra and others who claim to be part of the Avengers. We also have to make a distinction between negotiations, which look for some final conclusion, and conversations in which various possibilities are being explored, but without the necessary goal of a kind of an agreement. And it's really just much too early to tell which of these is actually going on.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Kimball. We have somebody here, Reverend Father Anthony, who is based in the northeastern part of Nigeria, but right now in Brooklyn, New York. And he has an important question to ask you based on his personal experience in Nigeria. So I want to bring Father Anthony on the air, who is a professor at a university within the northeastern part of Nigeria. Father Anthony?
Yes. Ambassador, thank you very much, Ambassador Campbell, for the insight and the input you have given on this all-important theme in restoring, trying to restore some sanity in Nigeria. But I want to just give you a little bit of input, giving my input with regards to the activities of the Avengers in the Niger Delta. According to the U.S. National Institute of Health, it says that the Niger Delta region itself contains about 20 billion Africa's proven 66 billion barrels of oil reserve and more than 3 trillion cubic meters of gas reserve. Now, looking at the enormity of these natural resources in Niger Delta, yet the people of Niger Delta region live in sharp poverty, and the residents drying their clothes on the oil and gas pipelines, and the crisscross of their neighbor, the Niger Delta residents, feed themselves by slaying wild animals and fishing from heavily contaminated ocean waters. Children play on beaches blackened by oil. And then we notice that those oil companies, those international oil companies, also provide security to defend their property. If I may ask, how did they view the life of these people who have the riches and are living in abject poverty? This is a social issue that unless and until it can be addressed, there is no any way forward. The second issue I want to also add here is about the Boko Haram in northeastern Nigeria. For over 30 years, we're made to understand that these fellows have been gathering resources and living in a place called Sambisa Forest. Why is it that the international community like the U.S. did not raise consciousness to the Nigerian government in whatever administration then to consciousness raise them to consciousness and tackle that issue. And that is leading to what it is, and it's affecting the economy of the country, and people who truly have nothing are suffering because of the riches of the country. So what would be your input with regards to U.S. Contribution to see that there's an end to this crisis? Thank you.
Thank you, Father. And let me take each of those questions in order. First, the fact that the Niger Delta is so underdeveloped, housing, schools, medical facilities, roads, you name it. The fact that it is so underdeveloped, when in fact it generates so much wealth, is a root cause of the whole series of insurrections that have taken place there over a long period of time. At various times, the Nigerian government has attempted to put in place a mechanism that would promote the development of the region. The Niger Delta Development Corporation is one. But they have been remarkably unsuccessful. I would also suggest that, in fact, the problems of the Niger Delta are a microcosm of the problems of Nigeria as a whole. That is to say, there is a tiny number of immensely rich people in Nigeria and an enormous number of terribly poor people in Nigeria, yet in a country with enormous natural resources. With respect to Boko Haram in the Northeast and why the international community did not early on bring pressure on the Nigerian government to address the movement, this is very tricky. Boko Haram is essentially an internal Nigerian matter. Nigeria is a sovereign state. The outsiders can assist another sovereign state, but only at the invitation of that sovereign state. I would also point out that a movement like Boko Haram became violent only fairly recently. Boko Haram became violent really after 2009 in the aftermath of the police extrajudiciously killing Boko Haram's Malam, Mohammed Yusuf. So it's a relatively recent thing. I am skeptical of reports that Boko Haram or its sort of antecedent organizations have been involved for a generation or so in building up infrastructure in the Zambezi forests. Maybe. But I would like to see some real hard evidence before accepting that as necessarily accurate.
And Ambassador Kembo, I just want to follow up with the last caller's question on Boko Haram. I know you've given a very important, insightful answer, response to that very question. There was a recent report which says that one of the girls abducted a few years ago was a kind of found by the military, and they have tried as much as they could to bring back the girls from wherever Boko Haram terrorist people have really kept them in bondage, hostage for so many months, years. I wanna ask, what exactly do you think is the problem with the Nigerian military? The Nigerian military has received enormous military equipment to be able to get these girls back. What exactly could be regarded or described as the difficulty that this military that helped so many years ago in many countries in Africa to end the war in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and many other places, that within that very country, big country called Nigeria, that the Nigerian military is unable to fight Boko Haram and release the girls who were abducted by this very group. And second question is the fact that Boko Haram has been seen as the most violent terrorist organization that has killed many, the most when compared with even ISIS or Al-Shabaab, even though they are a local terrorist network organization. So how could we really understand this kind of dynamics? Is it because of the locality where Boko Haram is located? I mean, many of those casualties or fatalities are not even reported in the media. So what is presented to us might be just a tip of an iceberg. What is not presented to us could be highly unbelievable. So the first question has to do with the weakness of the Nigerian military. And the second has to do with the rate, the level of fatalities that we have seen within Nigeria when compared with other terrorist organizations. It seems Boko Haram has committed the highest atrocities in the history of the world. What is their motivation?
To the Nigerian military, it was indeed in the past probably the most effective military in West Africa. And it performed credible service in ending civil wars in Sierra Leone, Liberia, and in providing peacekeepers for a variety of African Union or UN peacekeeping missions. What happened over the past 20 years or so is that the military was progressively run down. It was starved of resources, both of money, material, and also manpower. It was also the victim of extraordinary amount of corruption, so that money that was appropriated for use by the military very often never reached it. Why was the military deliberately run down? Part of it, I think, is it was part of a strategy pursued both by, oddly enough, military governments, but also civilian governments. It was part of a strategy to reduce the potential for military coups. Well, that potential was reduced, yes, but it also meant that the effectiveness of the Nigerian military was greatly reduced. And we saw that. We saw that from between 2011 and 2015, Boko Haram was progressively able to occupy more and more territory in northeastern Nigeria, and the Nigerian military couldn't dislodge them. Boko Haram was dislodged only starting in February or March 2015 by Chadian, Nigerian, as well as Nigerian militaries, plus South African-led mercenaries. President Buhari has instituted a number of reforms. He's fired a lot of corrupt generals. The former National Security Advisor is under investigation. But it's going to take a while to rebuild the Nigerian military to the point that it once was. With respect to the Chibok schoolgirls, it's really hard to find where they are. It's an immense amount of territory. People often think that air surveillance done by drones or light aircraft have much greater power than they really do have in terms of finding people. I think it's going to be a very long and very hard slog before the Chibok schoolgirls are found.
very, very sad, Ambassador Kembo, that the Lorgers have become victims. In addition with their families, they have become victims and paying the price for the inadequacies, the ineffectiveness of the Nigerian government. We're going to be taking.
Well, but now we need to go a little bit further than that.
Uh-huh.
There's a great deal of focus on the Chibok schoolgirls, but in fact, thousands of girls and women have been kidnapped by Boko Haram. Thousands. Some have indeed been released as Boko Haram has been driven back. But it's important to remember that this is a much larger problem than just the 200 or so Chibok schoolgirls.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be taking a short break. When we come back, we talk about our other emerging issues that are related to the Niger Delta Avengers war on oil installations in Nigeria.
This program is brought to you by ICERM Radio, a project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Welcome back to you, our guest, Ambassador John Kembo, who is a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria and who is currently the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations here in New York. Ambassador Kembo, let's look at the oil companies themselves. There are so many oil companies in Nigeria. We have Shell and so many other oil companies who are right now, of course, from a historical perspective, they have been involved in the conflict within the Niger Delta region. Many scholars have written a lot of books, have conducted research on the Niger Delta crisis. And some of the post-colonial critics argue that what we see as multinational companies, especially oil companies in Nigeria, in the Niger Delta, may be considered as a new colonialism tactic, a way to a kind of alienate the people and take away their resources and leave them without the means of survival. Do you think this might be a motivation to the problem we have, especially the emergence of the Niger Delta Avengers? Young people who think for a long time they have been abandoned, they have been neglected, even though the past administration in Nigeria gave amnesty. And as you said, this amnesty program has completely, the current administration has cut off so many things that are included in that very amnesty program. Could this be described as a way to express this very issue that many scholars have been talking about?
It's very easy to blame the international oil companies, and I think that blame is misplaced. It's important to remember that the oil and the gas in Nigeria is all the property of the state. It's all owned by the state. It is exploited. The oil is pumped. The gas is explored. It is exploited through joint ventures between the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, which is a government-owned oil company, and the international oil companies. In those joint ventures, the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation always has a majority of the shares. So, in fact, oil exploitation and gas exploitation in Nigeria
The majority of it is done by Nigerian entities, not
mm-hmm.
by the oil companies, the international oil companies. Now, the relationship between the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation and the international oil companies is often complicated. Too often in the past, the national oil company has had to borrow money from the international oil companies to pursue exploration of oil and gas reserves. That's simply, a single example. But the fact that the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation is the leading entity is one reason why there are no calls for nationalization of the oil industry in Nigeria, because it's already nationalized, in a sense.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. It's nationalized. There is a cooperation, which is a Nigerian petroleum cooperation, in charge of this exploration of oil from the
Niger
Delta.
And production.
And production
it's
as well.
It's done by joint venture or by joint agreement. And the national oil company always has the majority. It's normally 51 or 52%.
Mm-hmm. And my question right now is, if you look at the international economy, we discover that recently there is a decline in revenues generated through oil sales, especially in Nigeria. Why does the Nigerian government focus so much on the exploration of oil? Because there's going to be a time, most probably, the decline will become so high that there might be a need to look at other ways of earning revenue. So are there no ways to really look into other ways or means, especially here, for instance, here in the United States? There's so many ways through which people will be engaged. It's kind of innovation, and you know, the agricultural system here is well advanced. And Nigeria has got a whole lot of land, a whole lot of natural plants and all that. So couldn't there be a way kind of shift emphasis from oil to exploring other ways of building the economy of Nigeria? We just want to bring this very aspect to this very show. If you could elaborate based on your experience in Nigeria.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And the Buhari administration has put a great deal of emphasis on expansion of the agricultural sector, reestablishing the manufacturing sector, restoring the railways, and so forth. Trouble is, all of that takes time. In the short term, oil and gas revenue provide more than 90% of Nigeria's foreign exchange, and it constitutes more than 70% of total government revenue. So in the short term, the government is absolutely dependent on oil and gas. Over the longer term, if the present initiatives are successful, agriculture is expanded, manufacturing is reestablished, infrastructure is rebuilt, then indeed the kind of transformation of the economy from one based on oil and gas to something which is much more diverse and, in a sense, much more modern, that could change a lot for the better.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much, Ambassador Kembo. And there is a problem between the farmers and the herdsmen in Nigeria. I know you've been also monitoring that. So if the Nigerian government in the long term wants to establish or develop the agricultural sector, currently many herdsmen have killed a lot of farmers in Nigeria. Not only within the north northern part of Nigeria, but also in the southeastern part of Nigeria. How could we really understand? And of course, this increased as the Boko Haram terrorist activities heightened. And so we have an increase in the killings that are committed by the herdsmen, or a kind of conflict. The intensity of the conflict has increased between herdsmen and the farmers. How could you really explain that? Would you want to weigh
several,
on this kind of conflict?
There's several factors at play here. The conflict between herdsmen and farmers is made worse by climate change. As the Sahara moves south, former lands that could be used for pasture turn into desert. That pushes herdsmen towards the south, where they collide with farmers. In addition, Nigeria's population has soared. It's now something like 187 million people. That means the amount of vacant land available in some areas, particularly in parts of the north and parts of the middle belt, is shrinking. We can add to this the fact that in some places, the boundaries between herders and farmers correspond to ethnic and religious boundaries, so that in parts of the middle belt, there are Hausa, Fulani, herdsmen who are Muslim colliding with Christian Barome farmers. So, in fact, you have potential animosity piled on top of animosity. There is a great deal of thinking going on now in Nigeria about how to accommodate both herdsmen and farmers. There's a lot of quite imaginative thinking about how to address this issue.
And one of the problems could be as a result of the ethnic differences, religious differences, and the impute animosities that spanned so many years, especially after the Civil War in Nigeria. Now, I want to, the last question I want to ask you, I know your schedule is very, very tight. You got a lot of things to do, but if you could weigh on how to resolve, how to manage the Niger Delta Avengers war on oil installations. The Nigerian government has most probably initiated a committee to negotiate with the Niger Delta Avengers, and they are saying that they wouldn't want to negotiate with the government because their war is on the oil installations. So how could this kind of conflict be managed? How could this, before it turns into an ethnic war, another civil war that might break out, and in the process there might be some kind of alliance between the pro-Biafran people and the Avengers, Niger Delta Avengers, and the government of Nigeria? How could we, at this time, stop this government? What advice would you give to the Nigerian government, the Nigerian policymakers?
The first advice I would give to the Nigerian policymakers is to recognize that the roots of the Avengers, of the insurgency in the Delta region, the roots are very deep. The causes are quite complicated. I would hope that the government would pursue a multifaceted strategy, not simply using military force. Military force in the Delta doesn't work very well. It doesn't work very well because of the nature of the landscape. Further, security service abuses were a driver of Boko Haram recruitment in the north. Security service abuses in the Delta could do the same thing there. So the first thing the security services have to be aware of is a kind of fundamental rule, and that is first, do no harm. Then pursue some kind of multifaceted strategy to convince people in the Delta that, in fact, the government is on their side. Let me give you a specific example. Since the late colonial period, there has been discussion of the building of a road between Lagos and Port Harcourt, a new road. It's never happened.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, road construction is a way to absorb large numbers of unemployed youth. That's the kind of thing that could be done fairly quickly.
Mm. Thank you so much, Ambassador Kemble. I really want to appreciate the fact that you made our time to join us on iSun Radio, the iSun Radio program. Let's talk about it. With this, I would like to end this very show. I want to thank you in a special way for coming to join us today. Ambassador John Kemble is the Ralph Bunche Senior Fellow for Africa Policy Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations here in New York. And he is also a former U.S. ambassador to Nigeria from 2004 to 2007. Ambassador Kemble, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This program is brought to you by iSERM Radio, project of the International Center for Ethno-Religious Mediation, New York.
Visit www.icermmediation.org to make a donation or join our membership.
Thanks for listening to ICERM Radio, a global peace network dedicated to promoting inter-ethnic and inter-religious cooperation.
For complete information about the shows, including previous podcasts, visit the ICERM Radio website, www.icermmediation.org.
Stay connected. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and let your friends and colleagues know about us. Join us next time for another edition of ICERM Radio.
Peace to our world.
GEICO presents Sharing versus Oversharing. Today, Bridget.
Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever. Fios is not cable. We're wired differently, which means you can get the fastest internet available with equal upload and download speeds from 50 to 500 megs. So you can upload 200 photos before your favorite song is finished. Click the ad and switch to Fios today to get our best offer ever.